Hello and welcome to Motorsport 360, your look around the world of racing. I'm Naveen Razik and I'm joined, as always, by Joshua Carawalden. The year of racing is about to wrap up this weekend. The big two series we cover, Formula One and VIA Supercars, will have their final rounds. Formula One with the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, the championship though, already settled, whilst things are still up in the air here in Australia as we head to the first ever Newcastle 500. It's set to be a very big and very exciting weekend of racing. Before then, though, we do have some news about some departures from the Supercars grid for next year, which make the silly season and everything a little bit more interesting. We have news a couple of days ago that Jason Bright has called full-time on his career. He will step away from the main game from next season, although he hasn't ruled out a return in the Enduros. And the same thing happened this morning for Todd Kelly, who's, of course, one of the co-owners of Kelly Motorsports and Nissan Motorsports in Australia. He also will be giving up his seat at the end of the year and is also probably likely to come back as an enduro round. Before we talk about the silly season, though, I figured we probably should say something about the drivers, because even though they haven't exactly been high flyers, although Todd Kelly did spend a number of years with the Holden Racing Team, they've both been pretty solid drivers for the majority of their career. And what I would probably say is they're both very good number twos. They're both very good at just bringing in the points week after week. They haven't really had the success that they might have necessarily wanted, but they've certainly been pretty solid drivers. Todd Kelly with his 19 race wins and Jason Bright with his 20.
Yeah, I think that's the right assessment to give. Chronological order. We'll go with Jason Bright first. He had a very, many people forget how interesting, you know, the start to his professional racing career was. You know, he started, you know, going through Formula Ford and then, you know, did what was then known as the Australian Touring Car Championship for 2 to 3 seasons before an American open wheel switch to the Indy Lights and got a ride with Champ Car at Surface, which he unfortunately retired at, and then just continued, you know, just but you know, going through the Supercar season, and basically the most common assessment of Bright's you know, whole career in terms of the relationship with the teams is basically he was at the right teams at the wrong time. And you know, you look at, you know, FPR, you know, he was there in 2005 and 2006 when they're still like building, basically, you know, and they couldn't really manage a championship tilt. Holden Racing Team, you know, he was there in 2001, 2002, which sort of were, you know, the real peak years of the HRT, you know, the HRT brand and the HRT juggernaut. But you can sort of say that the team was more geared towards Mark Scaife at the time. You know, it went from two equal driver lineup of Mark Scaife and Craig Lowndes to Mark Scaife being lead driver and Jason Bright just being there for the sake of a second driver. Then, you know, he sort of lost his way, I feel, you know, going to his own team for 3 seasons. And then he went to Brad Jones Racing and you know, he really did make amends. You know, he was the guy who actually brought BJR, you know, their first, you know, basically their first race win. They, you know, he was the guy who brought them all the success and almost brought them a Bathurst 1000, you know, got close to a Bathurst 1000 victory with them a couple of times. So, yeah, you know, he's definitely had a very solid career, and, you know, he's definitely achieved quite a bit. You know, he's you know, gone to Le Mans, you know, he won the Bathurst 24-hour, he went to the 12 hours of Sebring. So, you know, he's done quite a few things, and, I think he can be pretty satisfied with himself. And on the other side of the coin, Todd Kelly, you know, he's had a much more Australian-based approach to supercars, and unlike Bright, he actually did win a Bathurst 1000 with Mark Scaife. And looking back on his career, it's sort of, you know, surprising, you know, especially with how, you know, fast he was at the start of his career. It's a little bit surprising that he's only had one Bathurst 1000 victory, even though He was partnered up with Greg Murphy for two 1000s, Mark Scafer three, his brother in 2006, Mark Scafer again in 2007, his brother Rick again in 2009. It's a little bit surprising how he's only managed to put together one Bathurst 1000 victory, but I'd imagine that he will be back for the 1000 again next year. Although at the same time, from all the reports this morning, it's sort of seeming like that he's just going to basically go straight into a team owner role. So yeah, I'm not sure how that's going to go. And it is a bit difficult to remember now, but in 2005 he did come pretty close to actually being the series champion. He did finish up in fourth place, and that was unfortunately he just had one of those careers where it was just an early peak. He finished fourth and then sixth and then sixth, and then he and his whole family, in 2008, basically took over what was then known as Perkins Engineering from Larry Perkins, and then that created and that formed Kelly Racing, and then it became Nissan Motorsport, which is what it is today, and he's never really been able to find the car speed since the takeover of Perkins Engineering, which is a shame. So yeah, he's definitely sacrificed a lot, and he's obviously called it quits. We'll just have to wait and see what he's got in store in terms of, is he going to be in the Enduro Cup 2018? We don't know yet. So yeah, there's that for Todd. And Jason, is he going to be in the Bathurst 12-hour next year? It's a possibility, but we'll have to wait and see. And is he going to do racing overseas? Is he going to try and find a Le Mans 24-hour drive, or is he going to do 24 hours at Daytona? I just feel like there's a lot more options available to Jason right now than compared to Todd.
Yeah, certainly Jason does have that international racing pedigree that Todd doesn't have. Now, talking about who's going to replace these guys, there's a couple of obvious ones, particularly for Jason Bright. We can almost certainly have that as a lock now for Richie Stanaway, who has, of course, had a fantastic breakout year in the Supercars Championship this year after spending time overseas racing all the way up to D2. And now we knew that ProDrive were keen to get him. He was co-driving, of course, with Cam Waters in the number 6 entry, and it looks now like Bright has effectively moved aside to allow that fourth spot at ProDrive to house Stanaway. As for Nissan, it's a bit more open. However, I would say that certainly there's a good chance that Jack LeBrock might get promoted up. He's, of course, done pretty well in the Dunlop Series. Not a great year this year with Nissan, but he finished last year in second for ProDrive Racing Australia. And, of course, he got a drive at the Bathurst 1000 and finished seventh with Todd Kelly. So he is also a good chance to replace him in the Altima, of course, though plenty still could happen. We don't know where Dale Wood could end up. He could end up back at Nissan for all we know. Certainly there's still plenty of other players who will be looking to get what is effectively a pretty solid, if not spectacular, seat somewhere in the Supercars grid.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, the silly season, it's definitely in full swing right now. We can almost definitely say now that Rick's, definitely going to be on again next year. Techno's becoming a very interesting one right now, as, Will Davison, is looking more and more worried in the lead up to Newcastle. He's actually said that, this could be, his last, event for a while. So, that's pretty, pretty extraordinary. So, definitely, someone along the lines of, Dale Wood can possibly slide in there. There's also Todd Hazelwood. Where's he going to go? As it's looking further and further unlikely that Matt Stone Racing will be able to move up from the Super 2 Series to the main game. The only way that they can do that is if they sort of cut a deal with Lucas Dumbrell to take one of their RECs off them, and so that they can run their own team. We did actually we did say this before briefly, but we did hear a couple of weeks ago that Lucas Dumbrell were basically going to make big announcements in the lead up to the Newcastle 500, and yeah, that is this weekend, and the track action doesn't start for another 3-4 days. So, you know, basically watch this space, basically. It really does, you know, open up, you know, and Bright's retirement effectively means there's a lot less swapping and changing going around. It could potentially be, you know, Bright's RSD, you know, basically remains parked alongside at Pro Drive, because there's no need anymore for the REC to go to Lucas Dumbrell. We've got James Golding. He's pretty likely to be, put into the 34 alongside Garf Tander, Gary Rogers. Tim Slade, he's very likely to stay at Brad Jones Racing, as well as Tim Blanchard. It's looking like Tim Blanchard will race for another season. And if I'm right in saying, I think that's all the remaining seats. So basically the big loser out of all this, you'd have to say, is Gary Jacobson, who for a long time now has basically been, you know, especially towards the start of this season, was, you know, basically earmarked as Bright's successor. However, you know, he hasn't had anywhere near as good of a year as what he did last year in the Super 2 Series, and he's basically been shafted for what seems to be a much faster Stanaway. So, you know, he's a real big loser in all this. It might be a case of, you know, he's going to have to do another year of Super 2 Series racing, and then, you know, probably he will find himself in a very competitive Enduro Cup seat, as the only three seats that have been confirmed for the Enduro Cup so far is Dean Kander with Mark Winterbottom, Alex Premel with Scott McLaughlin, and Steve Owen with Chaz Mostert. So, you know, he can feel free to shop around. So, yeah, I think, you know, this coming week we'll definitely see a lot more announcements in terms of who's going where in the supercar on the supercars grid. And I think Lucas Dumbrell will definitely be a one to watch over the next few days.
Yeah, certainly. Already there's plenty of movement at Lucas Dumbrell, of course, with Taz Douglas coming back this weekend to take the place of Jack Perkins, who was expected to do the final two rounds but can't race this weekend because of his Dunlop's commitments. They can't, of course, race in the main game when they're outside of Enduros. So a little bit of shuffling there. There's also a bit of a stoush brewing between the Holden teams and Triple Eight Race Engineering over the cost of the new ZB Commodores. Of course, Triple Eight have the exclusive rights to manufacture the new panels, and they're now being estimated to cost around $50,000 per car. They thought they'd be somewhere around $30,000 initially, but that has risen in cost, and there's been a bit of a standoff, particularly, and there was some very, very busy talks at the Gold Coast 600 round earlier this year. So there's a little bit of a stoush brewing here, which is, of course, one of those interesting things about the way the Supercar Series is set up, in the fact that Holden effectively and have given Triple Eight the exclusive rights to the car next year, which is a somewhat controversial move, and yeah, could effectively, if this standoff, see Triple Eight significantly benefit off the predicament that the other teams have managed to find themselves in. I don't want to say this will cause a two-tier championship, but it is a bit disappointing that this is sort of the way things have gone, and that, yeah, we're in a point where Triple Eight could effectively be one of the few teams running it next year simply because the other teams cannot afford it.
Yeah, well, I think this has been a pretty a political move made by the rest of the Holden teams, as I think, you know, it's, you know, they're definitely still in the negotiation phase, so I think this is a little bit of a political ploy, you know, going on around there, you know, just to try and find the best deal, because at the moment, the other teams are at this stage, you know, basically confirmed to get the ZB Commodore panels for next season at the start of the Adelaide 500 in March next year. Brad Jones, Erebus, and Techno with a likely exclamation mark alongside Team 18. There's been a lot of talk about Team 18, you know, being, you know, right there and up and ready to go. GRM, they're sort of taking a bit of a sit back and wait approach, and see what happens. And Walkinshaw and Andretti United I think, it's not really the top of their concerns with, just Walt Kinshaw, basically, informing team members from Andretti and from United Autosports, just, how the Supercars game goes. So, yeah, there's a question mark over that. And Lucas Dumbrell, at this stage, it's likely they'll switch to Ford, not for reasons relating to the ZB Commodore, but it's a happy coincidence. So, yeah, I think this is a bit of a a political play, and you sort of have to sit back and think that this never was going to be all Holden teams contributing to developing this this new aero package, this new ZB Commodore. It was always going to be one team, and the Red Bull Holden Racing Team was, basically the logical choice. And I wouldn't be surprised to, basically find out that that Red Bull under and Roland Dane under basically, very, I wouldn't say strict, but firm, recommendations, I should say, from Holden not to basically kick any Holden loyal competitive Holden teams out the door with this with these negotiations, as I don't really think that with the new car that's been that hasn't been received very well, I don't think that they want to suffer their chances of just having this car towards their back end of the field, because there's not enough competitive teams running the new Commodore. So yeah, I think, in Holden's best interest, they want it as cheap as possible. But, in terms of Roland's, best interest, that they're still, having to somehow fund, this ZB Commodore development, as well as the V6 turbo engine development, as well as continuing the R&D of the current package that they already have, so that they can challenge the likes of DJR Team Penske for championships. So yeah, it's a, it's a very, I wouldn't say difficult, but it's a very, there's a lot of factors in play at the moment. I really won't think that, there'll be a major fallout because of this, but I think, it's just, they're still in the negotiation phase, and they're just, playing a little bit of politics. Certain, players in this, in the negotiations are playing a little bit of politics, basically to get the best deal that they can, because that's ultimately what all parties involved want. They want the deal that best suits them. And yeah, there's definitely a little bit of hard line negotiations going on. So this has come out as a result. So yeah, I think watch this space. And yeah, I think, if it gets too messy, Holden, you would imagine Holden would step in, and basically say enough is enough. We choose the smaller competitive teams like Erebus, Techno, Brad Jones, GRM, and Malkinshaw, Andretti United, because we know that those teams can go out and win races, and we want them to win races in our product.
Yeah, certainly. And wrapping up, I guess, the Supercars headlines, we now know who the new CEO of the sports will be, Sean Saemer, who is a New Zealand CEO currently of Mediacom Australia, will be replacing James Warburton, who finishes up his tenure in December 22. Of course, this is effectively the sixth CEO Supercars has had in 9 years. There's certainly been plenty of instability at the top of the sport, particularly since Wayne Katak left at 2008. We've had a couple of guys come through and a couple of interim CEOs as well, but there's been a period of relative stability under James Warburton, and we talked about this earlier, where we didn't have any team fold, which was arguably something that not a lot of racing series can really trumpet. So certainly, whilst there's still a lot of work to do, and certainly there's a lot of stuff changing in Supercars management, of course the TV boss has left early this year, and there'll be some commercial sales manager stuff that still hasn't been filled. It'll be interesting to see how this guy goes. He looks like he's got the experience, and he looks like he's got the passion as well. He's a former amateur Porsche racer and enjoys his road and race cars. And certainly, I think the Supercar ship is in a pretty good place at the moment. A bit of instability possibly on the horizon, but I think they'll see it through. He certainly looks like he's a pretty decent choice for the role.
Yeah, absolutely. And he has he has also said that he'll actually be at Newcastle this weekend in a quote unquote unofficial capacity. So yeah, for from everything I've heard from basically about Sean and his current role, he's basically come out in the past few days and yeah, it says here he only told his staff of his departure on Monday morning, and he's already committed to going to Newcastle this weekend. So it just it shows that it's definitely a priority. He's definitely very interested in it, and considering that he was one of the guys that was basically headhunted from the outset. It just shows that it's I think it's a good good signing for both parties, as I think he could potentially enjoy both passions. So yeah, we'll just have to wait and see, and no doubt there will be interviews that he will give at Newcastle this weekend. So I think this coming weekend we'll find out a little bit more about Sean, and heading into 2018 we'll hear about what he what angles he wants to take the sport in, and what ideas he wants to bring to the table. And yeah, I think I think definitely at the start a lot of people will be keen to hear some of his ideas that he can bring forward to the table. So yeah, I generally do think that this has been a good signing, and yeah, for it to actually be done and booked away, and for him to actually come to the last event of the season is a really it's a good thing, because if we were still in December, rapidly heading towards Christmas, and still we didn't have a CEO for Supercars, then I'd definitely be a little bit worried. So because this has happened pretty swiftly, and Sean's actions in terms of notifying his current well his former staff, I should say now, of what is happening, and how he's actually coming down, and who knows, we could even see him at the Bathurst 12 hour this coming February. So with his swift enthusiasm and swift organization, I do feel that this is gonna be good, especially in the first 12 months. And yeah, I think it was highlighted that his biggest challenge will be negotiating with different manufacturers and finding out what exactly is going to be their selling point for them to actually commit to joining the Supercars grid.
Yeah, and that's something certainly the series is going to have to put a lot more work into over the next few years. So we're heading to the first final round of the Supercars Championship, and the first round at Newcastle is set to be a very interesting, very exciting track. The signs are good from what we've seen over the weekend, and we couldn't have asked for a closer championship. Only 30 points in it between Jamie Whincup and Scott McLaughlin. Whincup, of course, with a 30-point buffer, he is in the lead, and you could argue that given his experience with chasing down championships, he is the favourite. However, Scott McLaughlin doesn't have a huge amount of huge amount to do to, I guess, overtake him effectively. For McLaughlin to win, he would have to finish first for both races, and Whincup finish lower than third for both races as well. And that's, of course, to win it at the end of with no races left. Of course, that is all still up for grabs, certainly. If something happens to one or both of the drivers in the first or second race, it could have a major effect on the championship. But this is certainly going to be a very close run between the two of them, and you could have to argue they certainly would be both worthy winners should they win. Of course, McLaughlin does have the most wins out of everybody this season. He's had around seven, I believe, throughout the year. But Whincup has just been in a fantastic run of form ever since Barbagallo. He's basically only had two finishes outside of the tops. Just shows how strong he's been. Whincup, McLaughlin has also been strong as well, but he's been a little bit wayward over the last few races and didn't have a fantastic outing in Pukekohe. He finished on the podium but didn't get a win and wasn't able to close it up. Certainly, though, it is going to be very close indeed, and I suspect the new Newcastle track will certainly throw up plenty of curveballs throughout the weekend.
Yeah, it really will. Because I think over the past 1.5 to 2 weeks, I've personally been thinking about What type of track, you can categorize this on, in terms of, is it a high downforce circuit? Is it, more a straight line speed circuit? Because it's got a little bit of everything. There's three very key straights. There's also quite a few challenging downhill corners right alongside the beach, and then there's the Townsville inspired hairpin in the last few corners. So yeah, I think it's going to be a little bit of everything. I think brakes and tire torture will be. And tire cambers are definitely going to be, some of the main focus points coming up on this Friday. Passing is going to be, key, basically a key factor as well. And also, the hairpin itself. I think, there could potentially be a little bit of drama at the hairpin itself, in terms of passing. And I think it could be a bit of a high risk area. It's one of those hair. It's one of those corners. From what I've seen, it's one of those. It's probably going to be one of those corners where there's no real, safe line through there. Like if you go, if you approach the corner on the left hand side of the track on the inside, then you could easily be, done with, basically an over under where, the overtake where the car that wants to pass, can, brake a little bit early on the outside. And then overtake you on the inside, but then on the next corner, you're basically, you can go side by side through the final corner, and then it's, basically a run up to turn one. So there's that, and then on the outside as well, you could potentially do it, but you need a lot of tire grip. So like we can, theorize and, basically predict, what type of circuit, Newcastle is actually going to be. But, realistically, we won't really find out until, late Friday afternoon, or even on Saturday morning, to really know what this circuit is like, because the camber, and the actual roads around there seem pretty extreme in terms of, just how varied and how, unnatural it's going to be for the actual cars themselves. I think, it's going to be a pretty big challenge, and it's a little bit difficult. And just the actual straight onto the run up to the hairpin itself, I think it's going to be a real, key, a real, the real signature part of the circuit itself. As I just get the feeling, with how close and how tight it is to all the walls, I think it's going to become, personally, one of my favorite parts of the circuit, and, possibly one of the most favorite, one of the favorite parts, of any circuit in Australia, right up there, basically right up there with the top of the mountain at Bathurst. So, yeah, it's definitely going to be a real challenge, and Friday, I don't think there's been a Friday in a long, long time that's ever been so crucial.
Yeah, certainly. It is going to be very interesting. The drivers are going to have to make the most of every session. This is pretty much just a stupid question at this point, but let's put a basic prediction. Do you think Scott McLaughlin will be able to chase it right at the end, or do you think Wincup will just hold on and get what would be his first championship in quite a few years?
Well, I've been asking myself this question, ever since the second race at Pukekohe finished. I'll say one name, and then, immediately as I said, I'll regret not saying the other. It's just one of those situations, but I just get the feeling. I just get the feeling that DJR Tim Penske will have a slight advantage over Triple Eight. So I do think that McLaughlin will come out on top on Sunday afternoon and take the championship. As when you look at, how Wincup and McLaughlin have been on street circuits this year, obviously, excluding McLaughlin's penalty in race one, he had the edge over Wincup at Adelaide, then at Townsville. It was very much a checkerboard, both, very evenly matched. Service Paradise. Even though DJR Team Penske had terrible pace on Sunday morning, and their wet weather pace wasn't that good. Ultimately, they were pretty evenly matched, if not a slight advantage to Triple Eight. But I just get the feeling that Newcastle is more of an Adelaide street circuit compared to a Gold Coast street circuit. So yeah, I just get the feeling that especially with Ludo in his corner, that Scott McLaughlin is gonna have the advantage. And I think Shell V Power Racing will also DJ Tim Penske will also take the team's championship, as a 105-point buffer is quite a bit for Triple Eight to try and chase down this weekend. Like, it's doable, but I just get the feeling with Van Gisbergen's pretty checkered form, I think that DJR will take the team's championship as well this weekend.
Yeah, certainly going to be a close one. That, of course, kicks off this weekend in Newcastle. Not the only series, though, to finish their year this weekend. Formula One will wrap up the season in Abu Dhabi. Before then, we did get the news that New Zealander Brendan Hartley will have a drive with Toro Rosso for the next season alongside rookie Pierre Gasly. So it means that Toro Rosso will effectively be running two Formula One rookies, although Hartley has certainly considerable experience in the World Endurance Championship, and this effectively scuppers any chance that Hartley had of being in IndyCar. He will, however, stay in the Porsche family as well, so not a huge amount will change on his part, and there's still the possibility that he will be appearing in a number of GT events with them throughout the year. But certainly a big news for New Zealand motorsport, and big news for Brendan. We're not sure necessarily this was his aspiration, he certainly got a good chance. He will be stuck with a Honda engine next year, but he just needs to make the best with what he's got. And if he does that, then there is the possibility that he could really challenge to take up that extra seat at Red Bull. If or when Daniel Ricciardo or Max Verstappen finally decide to call it quits.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is very big for New Zealand motorsport. New Zealand and F1 have always had a bit of a awkward relationship for whatever reason. There's basically been one big wall separating the two for quite some time, but thankfully now that's sort of starting to erode away. Brendan definitely will be bringing some of his experience to the Toro Rosso and Honda development, and he could be a bit of a wild card that Red Bull can really utilize in terms of developing the Honda power units and getting them up to scratch with his experience in the World Endurance Championship with Porsche. I won't say it's going to be the most help that they're going to get over the next few years, but they can always call on him to provide a different perspective, so to say, in terms of where to go in terms of the Honda power unit. I think with all the instability at Toro Rosso this year in terms of their driver lineup, I think it's really good how that they've, for the final few races of this season, how they've elected to put in their two 2018 drivers for the final few races of 2017. I think that's a good idea. And, I think Gasly and Hartley, even though they might not really be ecstatic about having Honda engines next year, I think they're cautiously optimistic about the challenge that lie ahead. It's definitely gonna be, I feel it's gonna be a long year ahead for Toro Rosso, and I think that it's basically gonna be every experimentation with Honda and Red Bull, and I think they might try one or two pretty out of the box things, which could really make Toro Rosso suffer. But I feel like it's good for New Zealand motorsport, and I think it's good to have someone like Brendan in the F1 paddock, who's had quite a few experience, and just go to show that basically the F1 super license system that automatically grants 40 the full 40 super license points to the World Endurance Championship and in turn IndyCar is valid.
Yeah, certainly. I guess it's the first time I've had a, I guess, not necessarily what I call a major poaching from another series, but it is nice to see that there are still opportunities for those who have gone to different paths through endurance racing, the like, to make it into Formula One. Speaking of somebody who might possibly be going the other way, Fernando Alonso had a big test in Bahrain in a World Endurance car. He was with Toyota and logged 113 laps over the day and described it as pretty much awesome. He said it was fantastic to get the experience. And of course, Toyota will be in the World Endurance Championship next year. They've confirmed that. So now it certainly does look like Alonso getting the mileage in the endurance format. He will, of course, be racing at 24 Hours of Daytona. And you never know, there is the small possibility they might even figure at Le Mans next year. Of course, nothing is confirmed for that, but certainly it would arguably be on his radar. And it's nice to see that he's taken to endurance racing quite well, particularly when there is the possibility that after next season he will leave Formula One and possibly find himself a home in the WEC.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, he did do pretty well. You know, it was only I think about 6/10 of a second off the factory Toyota driver's time of Alex Wurz, who's definitely no slouch. So yeah, I think, yeah, it's a really good indication that, you know, he's definitely got a real good chance of actually being there at Le Mans next year. You know, it definitely definitely does help that there's no date clash. And also as well, I've just found out that I've just realised that the 6 hours of Spa, which is basically a dress rehearsal for the 24 Hours of Le Mans on May 5, doesn't actually clash with F1. So there's an opportunity there as well for him to slot that in there as a bit of a warm up alongside the 24 Hours of Daytona. But you'd have to say that he's in a very serious position to be in one of those Toyota seats. You know, it hasn't been confirmed yet how many cars Toyota will actually field for the 2018-2019 World Endurance Championship season yet, or how many they'll feature at Le Mans next year, but we'll have to wait and see on that. But yeah, you'd have to say that he's in very serious contention, and I think there will be, you know, members of the World Endurance Championship and, you know, some members of the FIA, you know, potentially encouraging Toyota to take Alonso on board, just to give, you know, the WEC a little bit more, you know, a little bit, you know, more publicity, and, you know, try and get it into the spotlight again, you know, in what is, you know, their most crucial season to date. So yeah, I think, you know, there definitely will be, you know, and even from Toyota's standpoint, I think, you know, that they'll also really, you know, want to have Alonso on board, and basically, you know, the possibility of having Alonso in their racing museum, being, you know, how, and, you know, telling future generations how Alonso raced with Toyota in order to complete his dream of getting the Motorsport Triple Crown. You know, that's definitely pretty tasty concept for Toyota. But on the other hand, you know, there's a small little leverage that, you know, sort of has to be considered as well with Renault. You know, you have to sort of, you know, consider whether or not Renault will be entirely happy that Alonso is wanting to race with Toyota at Le Mans next year. You know, you sort of have to consider how much leverage and how much influence Renault have over McLaren for 2018 and beyond. So, yeah, like, while it's pretty likely at the moment, there's still quite a few boxes that need to be ticked. And, yeah, when you have Alex Wurz basically say that Alonso did very well, and, you know, how he completed, you know, over 100 laps of Bahrain, you know, a second that he knows pretty well, I should add, you know, basically without incident, you know, it definitely puts him in very good contention. But at the same time, you know, there's 12 to 20 drivers that can also be with Toyota next year, who are also very capable. So, yeah, he's in contention at the moment, but yeah, there's still quite a few boxes that still need to be ticked.
Cool. So we're about to reach the final round of the Formula One World Championship. The actual title is done and dusted. Hamilton won it a few rounds ago at the Mexican Grand Prix in pretty thrilling circumstances. But since then, it's not exactly been fantastic running, of course, for the current world champion. He, of course, crashed out early in qualifying at Brazil, and as a result, effectively missed out on a podium. It was his rival, Sebastian Vettel, who got the win. And even though the championship is done and dusted, I reckon he'll be trying to try and end this season on a high with a win as well, because, of course, the last time he let his rival get a bit of a running start at the end of the year, that ultimately proved to hamper his run in the next season, and that is arguably how one of the reasons why he lost that title to Nico Rosberg, because Rosberg was able to carry the momentum. So I reckon Vettel, having taken that win at Brazil, will be very confident and be hoping to take another win just to get a bit of wind behind Ferrari's wings heading into the 2018 season. And I reckon Hamilton, similarly, will want to end his season on a high at probably one of the most luxurious, I guess, and also one of the most watched races of the year, even if it isn't a championship decider, and even if the track is a bit dull. Certainly, though, it's going to be a very important race to win for both drivers, even though the series is already done, because they'll want to have the momentum running into next year.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think Hamilton, it was actually pretty surprising how Mercedes as a whole, were so much faster than so much faster than what we were expecting, and yeah, it was I think you could argue it was the first time since Monza that Mercedes actually had the fastest overall package in terms of race trim at Brazil a couple of weekends ago. So all of a sudden, with all the pressure gone, Mercedes, seemed to be, right on the pace once again. And Abu Dhabi as a whole, you'd have to say, actually favors the Mercedes over the Ferrari and the Red Bull. As while there are a couple of tight technical corners, it's not really dependent on the chassis and the wheelbase and the long wheelbase that the Mercedes has. That's not actually going to really make that much of an impact this weekend. So I think Mercedes could potentially come home with a 1-2 on Sunday night. I could be proven wrong, but I just get the feeling that Mercedes have just all of a sudden turned up the wick, and I think that they'll be very, very fast at Abu Dhabi this weekend, and yeah, for sure, Ferrari, they definitely can challenge, but I just feel the with the larger with the with more with the circuit itself being more straights than actual corners itself, I just get the feeling that the Mercedes, will just have the edge. We'll just have the edge over them. But it really would be just a really good way to finish off the season with the classic Mercedes versus Ferrari fight for the win, and hopefully we get that. But I'm not that I'm not that convinced that we'll actually get it. And yeah, Red Bull, I think that they really should try and salvage a podium this weekend. Like Brazil was a very big wake up call that they've still got a long, long way to go in terms of actually being a legitimate championship contender and legitimate Grand Prix race winning contender each and every weekend. As yeah, Brazil, when we talk when everyone, including us, Naveen, when we all talked about Brazil so highly in terms of Red Bull's chances, and for them to turn up like they did and put in a performance like that, yeah, it just shows that that they still have got quite a bit to go. And yeah, I think with the general attitude amongst all Renault-powered teams, in terms of just making sure that the engine gets to the end of the race rather than try and chase for the result, I think it's going to be a pretty lackluster final race of the season for all the Renault power teams. And I'm not really expecting that much from Red Bull. I think that they'll just get fifth and sixth, and pack up, go back to Milton Keynes, and really get stuck into the 2018 car, the RB14, as hopefully for their sakes, I'd hope that it's a little bit better than the RB13.
Yeah, and certainly a lot of the fans will be hoping for a stronger showing from Red Bull, so that way we get at least a three-way competition for the title next year. That would certainly be something to watch. And then, of course, the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix that kicks off this weekend as well. Moving over to the United States, and looking through a few headlines, and this one, of course, comes up with the news that Danica Patrick will finish up her career at the Indy 500 last year. Now, of course, fountains of ink has been spent about the career of this woman who, let's face it, is an outsider in what is effectively a male-dominated sport, even more so in the United States. But she, of course, did have a pretty good run in IndyCar. A lot of people do forget that she was a regular in the top 10, finishing up in that series. Admittedly, not when it was at its strongest during the entire reunification era, but she, of course, did get that race win at Moti, which nobody can take away from her. She was a regular finisher in the top 10, drove for Andretti, then followed the money to NASCAR, and wasn't really able to hack it, like a number of other IndyCar drivers who tried to make the switch to NASCAR. People like Pablo Montoya, and even Supercars champions like Marcus Ambrose. It's such a difficult series to crack, and it wasn't necessarily that surprising that she sort of struggled to get herself into the top 20 during her tenure in stock car racing. But certainly, I think this is probably the best way for her to end her career. She will race at the Daytona 500. That'll be her final Cup Series race, and then she'll move back to, I guess, where it all started at Indianapolis, where she certainly, you wouldn't be surprised if she does have a decent run there. She does, of course, have several top 10 finishes in her first year at the racetrack. She finished fourth, and she's had plenty of other top 10s as well. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see the day where we don't have Danica being the polarizing figure that she is in American motorsport, but I reckon she's certainly had a good run, certainly pushed the barriers for women in motorsport. Say what you like about the way she's been treated and the way the media, and I guess she's been viewed by people in the American motorsport sphere, but she certainly had a pretty good run. You can't say anything less about her.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the big thing that really played her career is even though she was pretty good in IndyCar, she enjoyed NASCAR more. Even though she's faster in an IndyCar than she is in a NASCAR, so I think that's something that's really I'd almost say hampered the way people view her and will continue to view her. In terms of the results that she got, because she was better in the IndyCar, but she wanted to be in the in the stock cars in NASCAR. So yeah, but she just never had the speed. So yeah, that's one thing to keep in mind. And there's also 2013, where she basically got the pole. It wasn't a pole on debut at Daytona, but it was pretty impressive at the time. And for her to be running up, in the top 10 all day at the 2013 Daytona 500, that was, pretty impressive, you'd have to say. There would have been, quite a few people that would have hoped that, that was a sign of things to come, but unfortunately, it just wasn't to be. And, she'd have to wait, more than 12 months to get her next top 10, which came at Kansas in 2014. So yeah, that's a little bit disappointing. And she's always seemed to run pretty well at the Indy 500. Like her worst race, you'd have to say, would be 2008. But that was of course when she had to retire the car. Retire the car from a crash on lap 171. Where she was classified as 22nd. Her worst actual finish, where she actually finished, was 10th place. So, yeah, she's had a pretty impressive streak at the Indy 500, and she's definitely got the actual ability itself to actually be competitive at Indianapolis on the biggest weekend of motorsport. But it all depends on who she's actually going to drive for. For the Indy 500, as it's still yet to be confirmed. who will actually, field a car for her. So we'll have to wait and see on that. And it's never really been, she's never really had it easy. Like, she came into IndyCar when it was, arguably at its weakest, and then she had the, after a few seasons in IndyCar, she switched over to NASCAR because that's what she enjoyed. She's been continuously plagued by the fact that, she isn't as good at, in a NASCAR compared to what she is in IndyCar. So, she's, had a few things that have, really, been a little bit unlucky in her corner. And, for her to come away with, the win at Montague, in what was, pretty tense race, where it was, pretty dependent on fuel. And, it wasn't helped as well how, there were two IndyCar races on the one weekend in 2008 on that actual weekend where she won, with the other being at Long Beach. Doesn't make her look any better either. But she did get that win. I mean, and as you said, it couldn't be taken away from her. And she did have a trio of third place finishes at Detroit, Texas, and Homestead. So. Yeah, and I genuinely do feel that, I know that she, that she wouldn't be happy with how she finished at Homestead, crashing about, the halfway point, crashing out of the race, because, she has had a really good run of form there. Like, her worst finish at Homestead was 24th in 2015, so, she would have been looking forward to Homestead, because, she's actually been doing pretty well at Homestead, throughout her career, both in NASCAR and in IndyCar. So, you can sort of theorize, what might have been, but, at the same time, she did, sort of paved the way, the first female to get a pole position at the Daytona 500, first woman to lead the Indy 500, first woman to win an IndyCar race, highest woman finish in NASCAR, and NASCAR's top three series race, fourth place. First woman to lead the Coca-Cola 600, first woman to lead a Cup Series race on the green. Top tens by women in the Cup Series was 7, most laps led by women in the Cup Series was 64. So she's definitely, she'll definitely be, one that, many future, drivers, especially female drivers, will remember in the years to come. And, she did, accomplish quite a few first places, but, she did accomplish quite a few firsts. But, it seemed to be that there was always something, going against her. I just feel like, if she potentially stayed in IndyCar, she could have, potentially, got, a couple more race wins. But at the same time, she wouldn't have enjoyed herself anywhere near as much as what she would have in NASCAR. So, it's her whole career has been basically a double-edged sword.
Yeah, it certainly has been. She's been a polarizing figure, but she certainly has opened the way for a whole lot of other drivers. People like Sonny Silvestro came around the same time for her, and others like Catherine Legg and the like, and Pippa Mann, who've come after her. So certainly she has had a noticeable impact on American motorsport. Exactly how that will affect women in motorsport in the future, we're still yet to be seen. So let's move actually on to the NASCAR series, which wrapped up over the weekend, and it was Martin Truex Jr. who got a well-deserved cup title, fending off Kyle Busch to win the EcoBoost 400. Win the EcoBoost 400 and win the championship. Certainly, he has been a very deserving winner of this season. He's been consistent throughout. He's been a top finisher, and basically, because Kyle Larson, who was the other person, isn't exactly out, he's really just been the shoo-in for the championship all along. And he is certainly, a well-deserving winner. And after what happened last year, he'll certainly be very appreciative of the fact that he's managed to finally get it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it's very good to see, him actually take the championship, because, you have to say, through the whole season and all the 40 drivers have been, and all, 50 plus drivers have been in NASCAR this season, you'd have to say that Truex Jr. has been by by quite some margin, the most impressive. Like, his run of form has been absolutely amazing, unheard of. The amount of, top five finishes he got, the amount of stage wins he got, the amount of points he banked, it's been a very, very, very impressive season from Martin Truex Jr. And just I was, definitely, cheering him on, and definitely, really did want him to win. And what a turnaround as well for Furniture Row Racing, who, not that long ago were really struggling with Reagan Smith, just got top 10 finishes, and then Kurt Busch came along and really re-energized the team, and he was a very popular combination. Then Martin Truex came in, 2014, and was a bit of a learning year, in terms of how Furniture Row and how Martin really wanted it to work together. And just for a one car team to take out the Cup Series Championship and be one of the most dominant cars all season, is heading into a season where NASCAR is without Dale Earnhardt Jr. and without Danica Patrick, that storyline is as good as it gets, really. You could not really have a better, you couldn't have a better storyline than a one car team who, at the start of the decade, was really struggling to get top 10 finishes, to come out in 2017 and, be so dominant and take the championship. One of the best storylines from NASCAR that I've ever heard of. While it's not really on the same level as Leicester City, taking out the English Premier League and going on to play in the UEFA Champions League, this is right up there. Like, it's not on the same level, but this is right up there. So amazing. And definitely, Martin, he's been chasing his whole career to take this championship. He's 37. In 2015, he's pretty close, but just it didn't come together. 2016, it was close again, but Phoenix didn't go his way. He finished it was classified as 40th. He didn't finish. Then Homestead, last year, he had another terrible one. Classified as 36th, and in 2016, 2016 as well. He narrowly missed out on winning the Daytona 500. So very well deserved victory, and he broke down in the victory lane, and a very, very well deserved winner. And I'm very, very happy that that he got the championship with Furniture Row, who, as I said, have been 10 years ago, they were, the one cut that they were basically the part-time team that, basically turned up and failed to qualify for races. And, they've come around 10 years later, and taken the championship. Like, it's a fantastic storyline. And, what a better way to respond to Earnhardt with, Dale Jr. and Danica's, retirement with that storyline. You've got to be confident, you've got to have a bit of confidence that NASCAR won't take as big of a hit as what some people are sort of theorizing without the likes of Dale Jr. and Danica Patrick racing full-time in NASCAR next year.
Yeah, this is of course, the momentous final weekend of Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s full-time career, and there were plenty of people across the media and across the American landscape who came out to pay tribute to him. He really has been, he's effectively like the Craig Lowndes in Australia, or the Valentino Rossi in MotoGP, and it's just so difficult to see, to imagine what the series will be like without him, particularly Daytona next year, although you never know, if they might even run him as a part-time driver. He hasn't necessarily ruled out a part-time return sometime over the next few years, but certainly it's there's going to be a major shift in the way NASCAR has been, and this has of course been the first season with the new rule system, which has, to be honest, not made a huge difference to the racing. It hasn't necessarily ruined it. I wouldn't necessarily say it's made us better. It has been generally a pretty close season, but I reckon there's a whole amount of other factors in that as well. But certainly, this first year has certainly been the end of an era for some things and the start of an era for another thing. It certainly shows that NASCAR, which of course has to keep changing to keep up with the industry, and particularly all the stuff that they've done over the last few years to try and bring the series to a new audience. It's going to be very interesting to see how they go next year. Yeah, it is certainly a changed championship from where it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, it really is. And yeah, throughout that time, you know, they've really stepped up their social media game. Like, you know, how they utilize their social media is right up there with how well Formula E utilize it. You know, possibly, you know, even a little bit better, you know, you could potentially argue. And with the likes of Carl Larson and Austin Dillon, you know, really coming out to the forefront and, you know, really being, you know, well liked. Like, they don't have the, you know, the charisma of a Dale Earnhardt Jr. or Danica Patrick, but they're definitely well liked. So, yeah, and they'll definitely be around for like 10 plus years. And yeah, it's, and it's, you know, been, I'd say, you know, over the past, you know, few seasons in NASCAR, it's been a little bit, it's been, you know, quite enjoyable to actually see these young guys come up to the front. And yeah, like, you know, just last, you know, just on Monday morning, you know, Carl Larson, you know, how he actually raced at Homestead, you know, I think, you know, he actually had, you know, the fastest car, you know, for most of the race. You know, it was only in the final stage that, you know, he didn't actually put the win together, as he was overtaken by Truex Jr. And Kyle Busch. You know, Kyle was definitely very impressive with how close he got to the wall. And you'd have to say that Kyle Larson, you know, will definitely be a very, very serious championship contender next year. And that's what NASCAR needs. It needs, you know, the next generation of NASCAR drivers to be right up there, you know, racing very hard. And it's a little bit scary when you sort of start to consider that Jimmy Johnson is coming into the group, you know, it can actually now be classified as one of the more seasoned, you know, older drivers, you know, even though it doesn't feel like Jimmy's been around for that long, but, you know, when you actually look, he actually has. It's definitely a change in pace, and, yeah, definitely the way they use their social media, you know, is fantastic. They just need to it's basically a grind for them right now. Like, there's no real clear avenue for them to, you know, improve in terms of their social media. I think it's, you know, absolutely fantastic how they use their Instagram, their Facebook, their Twitter, their Snapchat. You know, it's all very, very it's all very, very good. And, you know, there's a lot of opportunity to really go behind the scenes and see, you know, what's going on all around the country in different NASCAR shops. It's definitely going to be a bit of a grind, you know, and, you know, definitely, I think, you know, right now that they, I think the big thing going forward is they just need to research a little bit in terms of, you know, their potential future audience and, you know, how to really rope them in and really make them even more enthusiastic and, you know, just trying to figure out, you know, what that they actually need to do to actually improve. So, yeah, while it's definitely, you know, while it's definitely not in a terrible position, you know, it definitely, NASCAR will definitely have its challenges over the next few years. But yeah, it'll be, I'm hopeful that they actually are going to, you know, put out some good ideas and, definitely continue what seems to be a pretty unstoppable juggernaut.
Yeah, certainly the NASCAR machine will keep rolling for another few years to come. So this final weekend of racing, I guess it will be coming up this weekend. I guess it's pretty much done for the year. Of course, Formula E starts in a couple of weeks, but we won't be around for that. We'll be taking a well-deserved summer holiday as a result. Next week, we'll be wrapping up everything that's happened in the Formula One and Supercars Championship, including the final rounds of both of those series and the Supercars Decider in particular. Will Scott McLaughlin or Jamie Whincup be the man to end the year on top? We'll have to wait and see. We'll be back, of course, to wrap all of it up and wrap up the year in motorsport. Until then, though, I've been Naveen Razik.
And I've been Josh Carroll.
And we'll see you next time. Goodbye.